That's a classic from Barry McGuire. It's called The Communion Song. It's 10 minutes after the hour, a winsome Wednesday morning here along the Broken Road, and we're joined by Doug Greenwald. Doug, the Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director of Preserving Bible Times, based out in Columbia, Maryland. Kind of, well, it's more closer to Washington than to Philadelphia, but I'll bet you can see the cloud of warm air over Philadelphia from where you sit there in Columbia, can't you?
Well, we try. You know, we always have this intense low-pressure area over Washington, D.C., and that disrupts the flow of the atmosphere.
But I had the pleasure of passing through your area. Well, in fact, we had lunch together. Had a great time meeting. Well, I knew you and your wife before, but I'd never seen where you lived before, the headquarters, the world headquarters of Preserving Bible Times.
Pretty impressive, is it?
Yeah, it is. It is a very impressive place, and surrounded by more traffic than you can shake a stick at. Boy, that was a busy place, driving through Washington on down through Virginia. And it was late in the day. I couldn't believe how many people were walking, running, driving, anything, anywhere, and bikes. More traffic than I care to think about. You don't see that kind of thing in East Dakota here, Doug.
That's one of the things that Washington, D.C. does that people don't realize is you come and visit here, and then when you go back home, you appreciate home so much more.
Well, it's true. Yeah. Yeah, and you are just down the pike from Philadelphia. You've been watching the convention, have you?
Oh, all that brotherly love stuff?
Yeah.
Well, actually, I've been intrigued with both conventions.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're both doing the same thing.
Sure.
You know, I'm an old marketing guy. And one of our old saws is that everything is marketing and marketing is everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you are seeing is marketing and marketing communications wherever you turn, wherever you look, wherever you blink, wherever you focus. Every phrase that's being uttered by somebody has been handcrafted by writers who have focus grouped notions, thoughts, phrases, and words. The orchestration, the flow of the thought development has all been scientifically thought through to provide the maximum impact. To create certain perceptions, whether they're reality or not, it doesn't even matter. You know, you're there to create perceptions. And both of them are doing it, and they're doing it at every turn. And I just wonder how many people sit back in their armchairs in their homes with their TV set on and realize what's going on and how all this has been shaped meticulously to evoke a certain sort of emotion or thought or conclusion, and to heck with reality.
Well, yeah, and I think of all that work and all that thought and preparation that goes into all that, and still I am not moved. And what a wasted effort that was. That went, no, I'm not going to respond to that. I think many of us, I don't know if I dare say most of us here, I'm talking about the electorate, the people of the U.S., anyway, people who have gone to school, look at that and say, I can see right through that. I'm not going to let myself respond to that. That's silly. I will not be manipulated. But there must be certainly an element of the population that just falls for it. If they can, lift their eyes from their cell phones long enough to
the
watch
people
what's
crafting
going on.
These two conventions mm-hmm. aren't stupid. They're doing it because they're convinced it works. And why are they convinced it works? Because they feel it's worked in the past. So mm-hmm. your notion that people can see right through this, I think, is fallacious.
Yeah, could be.
Yeah, no, people can't see through it. They've been sold this line before, and they're going to keep being sold it in the future. I mean, it's way beyond.
I wonder if this was true of generations before for television then, which gives you everything, tells you how to think and when to think it. Before TV, was it different?
Well, it'd be real interesting to read the newspapers of 50 years ago, or maybe mm-hmm. a little bit longer than that. You know, did the editorial pages shape the vast majority of the American opinion?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they do anymore. But things are so subtle, too. Now, what are the colors of the American flag?
Well, red, white, and blue.
Let's see, red, white, and blue.
So when you saw the Republican convention, you saw red, white, and blue everywhere,
mm-hmm.
right? Yep. Do you notice the color that's missing at the Democratic convention?
Red. Red states, yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. They don't want the subliminal message that there are red states, there are Republican states out there. They want everything to be blue.
Mm-hmm.
And there wasn't, I don't know that there were flags at all.
There were toward the end of the day yesterday. I saw some of that.
Yesterday, yeah, but not Monday.
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
Then there's a whole other dynamic out there is that people have paradigms. And there are two, let's say that there are three paradigms out there. There's a Republican paradigm, there's a Democratic paradigm, and let's say there's an independent paradigm. Well, the people who are stuck in a Republican paradigm, they'll look at that whole Democratic thing and sneer at it, basically, right? Mm-hmm. And what do you think the Democrats who are stuck in their paradigm, how did they react to what the Republicans put on media?
Same.
Same way. Yeah. It's the whole notion that we are prisoners of our paradigms. And so I think very little gets persuaded one way or another, but maybe there are still this unique bird out there called independents who actually are trying to make up their minds. I mean, that's who this whole thing is pitched for. But I also find it interesting that, the vast majority of these messages are either going to be completely embraced or completely rejected, depending on the particular paradigm of the person viewing and listening.
Mm-hmm. A little inside baseball as far as politics on the ground. When we get back in 08, we got maps of the neighborhoods that we were going to be campaigning in, walking door to door and knocking on people's doors. And they were listed, each individual person that lived in the house was listed as a hard right, solid, you know, unconvincible right, hard right, middle, soft, mushy, somewhat left, and a hard left. And you would ignore the bottom three categories. You would only talk to those people who were absolutely, totally convinced of what your rightness was when you walked up to the door. It said, you're wasting your time with those other people. You're never going to convince them of anything. You know, don't waste your time. You got 5,000 doors to knock on. You got no time to talk to the folks that don't believe you.
So this had to do with turning out the vote then rather than winning people over.
Let's, to use a biblical phrase here, let's take that thought captive and bring it into the church. You think people and pastors and church leaders have paradigms?
Oh, yes.
You think they are fixed paradigms, that they're prisoners of their own paradigms as well?
For generations.
How do you get pastors and church leaders and even people in the pew to change their viewpoint, to realize something's wrong, to realize something's missing, when they, like everyone else in the United States, for whatever the topic is pretty well entrenched in a certain paradigm? That's the challenge that Preserving Bible Times has, among others. Mm-hmm. How do you get the evangelical church to realize that context really matters? How do you get the evangelical church to realize it's literally doing some things that are injurious to the flock, not helpful, but they can't see it? How do you get them to realize that there are huge holes in what they're doing? There's stuff MIA, missing in action. How do you penetrate those defense mechanisms? So, you know, the issues are the same wherever you go. The subjects may change, but the dynamics remain the same. And welcome to my world.
Is faith as difficult to work with as politics, or maybe more so? I mean, it's more it's a stronger core value, I would think, than the political leaning.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And so there are different theological systems out there. And therefore, there are different theological grids, and therefore, there are different places that people are stuck in, wedded to, fully committed to a certain perspective, theologically speaking, which is different from this theological perspective. And so a passage will get interpreted and viewed in very different ways, depending on the presuppositions that your theological system forces you, causes you, suggests you, prompts you to bring to interpretation of a passage. So the dynamics are the same. The challenges are the same. How do you get people outside of their paradigms? How do we get people who have become prisoners of their paradigms to be able to break free? Jesus said, I have come to set the prisoners free. And yet the irony of that is many of us are prisoners of our paradigms, and that's a very inhibiting barrier to further moving down robustly in the journey of faith.
Can you define for me, please, the difference or the line of separation between evangelical churches and the more traditional liturgical churches? know, I'm thinking of strict Lutherans and Presbyterians and Anglicans and Catholics, as opposed to evangelical free and United Methodist. And is there a real line of demarcation there? Can you set aside liturgy from other?
Well, I would say the word evangelical can be applied within any given denomination. It's a function of what the church is doing. Mm-hmm. You can be a liturgical church and still be completely sold out for Jesus Christ and engaging the world to bring people into the kingdom of God. And this, you know, a mile away, there could be another liturgical church of the same denomination, which is just content to be a holy huddle.
Yeah, but I guess what I'm asking is, are they all doing it the same? Or are there real differences? You know, in the West, I'm talking the Western church here, the United States of America.
Well, there have been strains, you know, at 30,000 feet, some denominations, and I'm not going to use labels because I'm getting too particular here, but are more wedded to social justice as a what they think is an evangelical strategy. And other denominations are more wedded to what I'll call a proclamation approach to spreading the gospel of Jesus Christ. You know, one sort of direct, one sort of indirect. They disagree with each other as to which is the most effective. But yeah, there are different approaches to that.
And I've seen some that are very, very strong on local mission work. You know, they'll flood neighborhoods of elderly and poor people and doing things to fix up yards and paint and take care of people. And I love to see that. I don't know how widespread that is, though, because I live in one place.
Yeah, in the last 10, 15 years, the word missional has really burst onto the Western evangelical scene. We want to be a missional church. And there are different definitions and different understandings of what that means. But yes, I mean, a church has to be a few things all at the same time. And that, okay, let's go down this road. I'm going to get there indirectly here. Mm-hmm. Have you got a vision statement for Broken Road?
Well, yeah, and it's when you say vision statement, positioning statement, 2 Corinthians 10:5. In fact, you mentioned part of it in taking the thought captive. That 2 Corinthians 10:5. That's our core value right there.
What? But can you recite for me what your vision statement is? What your purpose statement is? What are you trying to do in one sentence?
We are trying to reach an audience, a baby boomer audience, so that defines our target market, if you will. No, I can't put it in a concise sentence for you.
We're trying to reach.
I think so.
Well, freeze that thought, because we'll return to it here in 15 minutes. But now let me shift to your respective churches, either the ones you're in now or the ones you recently have been in. Tell me their mission statements. Tell me their purpose vision statements.
Well, they're paragraphs, and I can't recite it to you.
Ours is
I have to pull out a bulletin or something with it.
Worship and then go out into the world to, and the convert's not there. But I'm looking around for a brochure or something. But
makes reference to fulfilling the Great Commission.
It's something along those lines. Yeah, the go gather and I should know this, shouldn't I?
Well, you guys have just illustrated the issue.
Yeah, we don't know what we're doing.
If you don't know what your church's mission statement is, boom, boom, boom. If it's more than one sentence, there's something wrong with it. If you can't immediately recite it to someone else, something's wrong here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to use a little bit of hyperbole, but am I making the point that I
get
your attention?
Yes, you are. Yeah.
Go, grow, and gather. That's ours.
That one, yeah, I better not comment on that because that probably is a statement for a certain church. But it's one thing to have a statement, and you're illustrating the issue here. What good is it if you can't remember? And then there's a secondary issue here. Is it even a good statement? Does it nail the essentials, or is it a half a loaf? So let's take this thing in sequence here, because this is a profound issue all throughout the Western Evangelical Church. If you ask 50 people or 100 people, what's the vision statement of your church? And you get different degrees back of, I'm not sure, I don't know. Isn't this a prima facie case that we have a huge problem? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you don't know what the church is about, then what are you supposed to be about? Is this problem so so immense that we can't see it? So big we can't focus on it?
And if that's the case, how do you tackle it? How do you recognize it as a problem?
Exactly. It's such a profound omission. It's such a profound hole that we don't even see it as a problem.
We go, I mean, we see those three words every Sunday, and it's on all the brochures, and it's on all the literature, and it's always there. And I don't remember anybody ever talking about it.
Maybe well, see, that's a whole other issue, is the vision statement connected to the weekly reality of the congregation?
Right.
Is it repeatedly driven home so that morning, noon, and night, you wake up, you know exactly what those three things are and what it's going to mean for your day? But that's getting ahead of myself here. About 30 years ago, when I was in the corporate world, I was sent to a day-long conference on vision and purpose statements. And one of the things that was said very quickly is, if your mission statement is more than one sentence long, it's really weak.
Well, you see, there are different, and I object to that, because there are different kinds of statements, and people confuse positioning statements and slogans and advertising and marketing catchphrases and mission statements. A mission statement, to me, can be more complex. And if you look at our About Us page on Broken Road Radio, you'll see we describe what we do. What we don't say is why.
I think a one-sentence purpose or mission statement may have some asterisks on it, you know, where it's explained in more depth down below. But people can't remember paragraphs.
Well, and there's the key, a positioning statement, and I've spent years in advertising. It needs to be short, easily memorized, and repeated endlessly.
Yeah, so
it appears in everything you do.
When I was at this vision purpose statement seminar 30 years ago, here an example was given of a company of firefighters who had this as their vision statement, purpose statement. I'm going to do V and P sort of together here. To prevent and put out fires. Can you remember that one?
I like it. Yeah.
That's it in its essence. Okay. It captures exactly what they're trying to do. It doesn't have to be long. I heard it once 30 years ago, and I can still repeat it in an instant. It's memorable.
And again, that says what, but not why. So you might want to elaborate on that. I mean, if anybody had any doubts about why a fire can be disastrous or harmful, then they might read that and understand.
Oh, you could probably write pages on how you put out fires and pages how you prevent fires, but that doesn't change the essence that it's to put out and prevent fires.
Well, that's it. But then there's the positioning statement, which is intended to set you apart from your competition. It distinguishes you from the pack. And you know, the classic ones in advertising, my personal favorite is plop, plop, fizz, fizz. I mean, everybody knows what the product is and how you use it from that. Oh, what a relief it is. Now, they haven't used it since the 60s, but it's so well known, even youngsters know what that is.
Yeah, positioning statements are meant to create differentiation, to use marketing jargon here, but the purpose statement is just sort of the essence of what you're about. And so let's come up with a generic vision purpose statement for any evangelical church today. Okay. Got any nominations?
I'm trying to decide if it relies on what you might call remez. In other words, if we say Great Commission, Christians relate to that, what they think that is. And so that's easy to incorporate without explaining, you know. But that probably ought to be part of it. That and it may not be truly a great commission. It might be, as you have taught us, a great assumption, but it's still a noteworthy, a noble, and valuable thing for a church to do.
All right, let's stay here with the Great Commission.
Mm-hmm.
And let me try to put something memorable together. That's one sentence.
But it's a shortcut. It doesn't explain what it is. It uses a phrase that most people would relate to and understand already.
But let me craft one here. And my first test is whether you can repeat it back to me, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So here it is. Here's my starting model, vision, purpose statement for any church. Discipling is everything, and everything is making disciples.
Okay.
What does that suggest the church is about?
Well, if you know what discipling means, if you don't confuse it with evangelizing, if you understand it's something separate and longer term, then it means enriching people with Christian life, with Christian participation, with Christian commitment. And understanding.
My first reaction, and this is from the decades of going to church and belonging to different churches, is just we don't have as many butts in the pews that we need. Let's go out and get some more members. That's what that says to me.
Well, that statement should say what we're about is making disciples. Agree or disagree?
Agreed.
Agreed.
So if there are church purpose mission statements, vision statements, that have no mention of the words making disciples, what should we conclude?
That they don't make disciples. That's not a commitment.
Yeah, and isn't that a huge issue?
It is.
Does that explain why there's not a whole lot of disciple making going on?
And yet they will still maintain that they're faithfully serving the Great Commission.
Well, there is such a thing as called fruit. Show me the fruit.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to make a very, very simple point, springing off your reference to the Great Commission, which is about making disciples. Okay, if we have a purpose statement that doesn't mention the making of disciples, is it majoring in minors? Is it the emphasis of the wrong syllable? Is there something wrong here?
Well, I think so, and I think it's endemic to the Western Church. I think, as David put it, butts in the pews are the priority, because that's survival week to week. That's meeting the bills. That's establishing another campus across town. You know.
Okay. The rest of the phrase, go, grow, and gather, is grow in God's word and grace. Gather other, go forward in faith to serve. It's on one of these little time things. And so the first one is coming around here. And gather in worship. So gather in worship tells me get more people in the pews. A marketing thing. I mean, gather to find more people to become disciples would be a better way of explaining that. But that's a gap that's not.
See, covered. I think that's a cynical view, unless you experience that in your church, unless that's the correct interpretation based upon your experience with the church. The words alone, though, gather together to worship, I don't see anything scary about that. I mean, the gathering together part is positive. We're called to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we live in a community.
No, I didn't say it was a scary thing. I don't know that it's discipling. I'm not convinced that sitting in a pew next to somebody is necessarily discipling anybody, because you don't talk to them until next week.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't even talk to them that week.
Let me comment that, having been to hundreds of churches, there are a goodly number of churches that have paragraphs as their vision statement. And I can almost guarantee you, people don't know what's in it and can't recite it.
Mm-hmm.
But some churches have short ones. David, the one you're reading there is short and without a lot of work would be memorable. The issue then is, does it capture the essence pieces of the journey of faith? There are, you know, maybe one out of four churches that have something like this. To know God, to serve the body, and to engage the world. Now, there are three spheres there: God, body, life, world. That's actually biblical. That's consistent with John 15 and the flow of the three thematic themes in John 15. That's pretty good. That's solid. And so let's put these two thoughts together now. Being disciples and making disciples who know God, serve the body, and engage the world. I think that's actually a pretty good one.
It's comprehensive. I'm not sure how easily I could remember it, though. I'd have to practice that. But the concepts are strong.
Yeah, I could...
You know, wordsmith that a little bit. But
yeah, and I can shrink it down and say making disciples by know, serve, and engage, you know, the key words.
But is disciple a useful word? I mean, it's a descriptive, it's accurate, it's right, but is there a common understanding?
Yeah. You're actually at phase two. But let's at least get the right sentence or the right phrase. And then we can now teach our people, what is a biblical disciple? What does it look like? What does it mean to know God? Not know about God, but know God. What does it mean to serve the body in life-giving ways? What does it mean to engage the world in transformative ways? I mean, now you can start to expand this, flesh it out, add more meat to the bones, if you will. But the structure is still solid. It's still good. It's still a very useful umbrella because it reminds us all of what is the main thing. Anyway.
Got a couple of listener inputs here. Guest 993 says, believe, connect, grow, serve. Our church expands on these. Believe, connect, grow, serve. And believe, I'm reading the next one. Yeah, believe, grow, connect, serve. That's not complicated.
No, and the, you know, the question is, does it fully capture the knowing God part of it? You know, I can believe in Jesus without actually having an intimate relationship with him.
Yeah, and then we have to define believe
too. Because believe is often a creedal kind of thing.
Yeah. Interesting. It makes me want to go to work for Broken Road Radio here and see if I can craft a statement of our own, because we are missional. And it relates to the Great Commission, but we just do things a little differently than a church would do, you know.
Well, I would encourage you to come up with a missional statement of 12 words or less.
Well,
it might be enormously helpful. At least once every other hour, you recite it. Remind people why you're doing what you're doing.
Here's another question for us from a listener. How can one possibly presume to know God? How can one believe one can know the ineffable?
Know has to be defined. And I don't want to use the Western thought process for know. I want to use the Old Testament biblical process for knowing. And it's in Genesis. And it says, Adam knew Eve, and she conceived and bore a son. Know means intimacy.
Okay.
To have an intimate relationship with the Creator God. It's different than saying you're capable of knowing everything about him. You can't, because he's infinite. Okay.
So it says relationship, not understanding.
And it's the kind of relationship, an intimate relationship.
Yeah, good question out there. Thank you, SAS. Yeah. Okay. How are you doing with your project, your Discipleship Reset project?
Well, I'm doing lots of reading. And I've been really pleased with my reading. You know, I teach for about 6 hours on some of our weekends here, one of which is Making Disciples Jesus' Way. And it's the sort of contextual insights that I've been blessed to focus on over the last 10 years or so. But I often wonder, boy, I sure hope I'm not leading people astray with these observations I make, these suggestions that I make. And so far, what I've discovered is that what some pretty authoritative people apparently think are core issues are the ones that I've been articulating. Yeah, I've been articulating them in different ways, but it's been good for me to realize, and I'm saying thank goodness I haven't been leading people astray. Mm-hmm. So that's one part. The second part now is to continue this reading to see how all these people are fleshing out, I'll call them the drivers, the key elements, the catalytic things, the spark plugs that make for very fruitful discipling, and see how that can be organized for the typical church to be used both as a diagnostic tool and a therapeutic tool. And that's probably 6 months to a year away. Mm-hmm. But it is fun already to start to think in some of those ways, and to also wonder, is there something that's still been missed here? Mm-hmm. For example, I mean, just little things show up on my horizon here. I don't know how they're going to fit in the mosaic when all is said and done. But I was talking with a person a couple weeks ago about their last 12 months and their journey. They had to move away and get into a strange community. And this person was saying, now that he's come back and re-entered the community that he's long been a part of, I had no idea what it was like to feel for a year that I didn't belong. Mm-hmm. And I thought, belong. Is belonging an absolutely essential attribute, characteristic, dynamic that has to be in place for fruitful discipling to occur? I think it does. And so, you know, that's just an example of a variable, a piece of the equation. You gotta belong. You gotta have a sense of belonging, a place where you feel safe, a place where you feel accepted.
I mean, if a confidence that you're in the right place where you should be.
Huh?
I think it's also a matter of feeling you're in the right place where you should be. It's comfort, but it's more than just comfort. It's being a valid or validated part of. You know, it's that community notion.
And, you know, I tend to want to put an adjective in front of community to underscore the fact it's life-giving community. Mm-hmm. Not just community in the sense that we're all in proximity to each other.
Not an organization, but a community. And
exactly. I mean, adjectives start to become important after a while here to further define the nature and character of a community.
You know, that's what makes your job so difficult, is there's so many different interpretations and understandings and definitions that apply to the terms you use. You almost have to explain the words you're using in order to get your meaning across.
Well, that's a given. Yeah. I'm not assuming that when I use words in a one-sentence mission statement that everyone has the three-dimensional understanding contextually of what those words are, but that's what where you then jump off. That's what mm-hmm. you start to do. One of the things I've been absolutely struck by, even in these expert books, is nobody really is defining what a disciple looks like. Mm-hmm. And in Making Disciples Jesus' Way, when we contextually get into the rabbi-disciple dynamic of the first century, which I would suggest is the context for that word, that's where it gets defined, you can, after a while, say, here are the eight essential characteristics of a first century disciple. I don't think they've gone away. I don't think they've changed. But I think that's where we ought to start. Mm-hmm. Do we know what a disciple looks like, biblically speaking? And that appears to be a hole right now, even in the best written material. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting and intriguing to see where this thing heads up.
I've always taken your grasp of first century Middle Eastern context to be your source for credibility. And it's powerful because, it's different, but it's so authentic and so logical and so rational that if you understand the Bible the way the original audience understood it, in their circumstance, in their context, then the meaning becomes clear. But we've been floating around at the mercy of philosophers and theologians for 2,000 years since then. And I think we've drifted.
Yeah, if you're disconnected from context, then you're free to give the words the definitional meaning that you wish to. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a lot of what's happened. The word disciple has an original meaning, a biblical meaning, and it also has a Western evangelical meaning, which could almost be light years apart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one other thought, a couple more thoughts in the chat window. We can't address all these in detail now, but yes, 226 offers us, no matter how concise your mission statement is, it is just the foundation. If someone is truly interested in your message, they'll ask for a more in-depth explanation. So you need to have that ready.
And I would simply say it all starts with a firm foundation. Mm-hmm. If your foundation is flawed, your superstructure is going to be flawed. And yes, you have to build the superstructure on top of the foundation, but let's at least get the foundational statement straight.
Yeah, well, I'm going to work on our mission statement. I am. I'll do it this week. We'll greet you with it next week. How's that?
I look forward to that.
Talking with Doug Greenwald, Senior Teaching Fellow at Preserving Bible Times and the Executive Director there. And you can visit them. You can visit Doug. See a lot of what he does on the website at preservingbibletimes.org. You can sign up for his monthly Reflections newsletter, which really now is more often than monthly. And Ned, get comes to you, doesn't cost you anything, comes to you via email, and it will light up your day when it arrives. So, Doug, have a terrific week, and thank you so much for what you brought to
us. Thanks, guys. Yeah, shalom, shalom.
Thanks, Doug.